Hey everyone, this is Carlos Morales, and this is the Think About Now podcast. First and foremost, need to get a little bit of business out of the way real quick. On March 18th, I'm going to be giving a speech in Phoenix at the San Carlos Hotel. My name is Carlos. I'm going to be speaking at the San Carlos Hotel, and it's going to be awesome. I'm going to be giving a little bit of speech on the topic of child protective services. The actual name of the event is, let me go and double check, Family Rights Summit with CPS whistleblower Carlos Morales. And it's going to be hosted by the Maricopa County Libertarian Party. I will tell you, though, that the person who really put us all together, and she's just this awesome, radiant human being, is Marissa Hamilton. She works at the Libertarian Party out in Maricopa County in Arizona. And she is great. And so I'm really glad to be able to give this speech. It's going to be Saturday, March 18th from 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. 202 North Central Avenue, Phoenix, Arizona, 85004. So check that out. So today I'm going to be doing something a little bit different than the normal show, right? The normal show involves me doing 8 to 20 hours of research, whatever, in order to be able to publish a specific podcast that ends up coming out is only about 20 minutes. And the problem with that is that I don't really get out enough content because I'm like a musician. I work in the mortgage industry, which no one really knows about. I'm never going to really talk about, as well as I write, right? So those are, and I attempt to have some kind of personal life. So in between all those things, I've found that the amount of content that we're able to kind of push out has been a little bit laxed, I'll be honest. It's taking me forever to push out these episodes, and that's a little bit of annoying to me because I know there's a lot of, you know, really cool people out there who listen to this show and go, hey, you should like produce more. And so I listened to all these other podcasts, and I realized that the majority of them don't prepare at all, like at all. Now, granted, a lot of them actually have funny people. Like Bill Burr, right? Great podcast. Driving around, he just talks, makes you laugh your ass off, right? People like Joe Rogan, he has really interesting people on his show, right? So they have that kind of style. But I figured, you know, after 3 years of podcasting, I should be able to have the ability to not have any kind of script in front of me or anything else and be able to just kind of talk for a little bit. But in order to be able to put it, though, as a connection with other people in this environment, I wanted to do some questions and answers because over the years, I've actually gotten all these different questions asked to me regarding the podcast and child protective services as a whole regarding kind of, hey, what do you think about this? You know, you've done this podcast series in this particular topic. Let's go ahead and talk about that. So I have a few little questions here that I'm going to get to and we'll start right here. So I went ahead and I sent out a little query on the Think About Now Facebook group, which delivered a few little questions on there, but there's a lot more that were actually in my Gmail and my inbox that I went ahead and checked and figured, hey, what the hell, why not answer some questions that people were asking? And of course, the first one I'm going to hit on right now is on the topic of drugs. This is from Nick Hazelton. What are your thoughts on using mind-altering substances as a tool to learn more about your psyche? So on this particular topic, I haven't been quiet about my positive viewpoints in regards to taking psychedelics in order to kind of see your inner subconscious and deal with the filters that are kind of running your lives, right? So the majority of us as human beings, whenever we're viewing anything, first and foremost, we're always viewing the past because any single time an image comes into our head, we have to flip the image first in order to be able to best interpret it, right? Or to be able to interpret it at all. So we're always existing a little bit further back. Plus, there are obviously multiple colors and different parts of reality that we're not even able to witness at any given moment. So we're always looking through a specific lens that is our own subjective reality. And when we're dealing with things like memory or our own thought patterns, it can come to a point where most of our lives are run off of filters and stories that we tell about ourselves. So I kind of went into this in my Anarcho-Poco speech, but I'll kind of hit it on it here. The majority of our life is run off of stories that we tell ourselves, right? That we're bad, that we're wicked, or that we're great, or we're heroes. We live off these tales because of specific events that occurred in the past, right? Like, let's say you cheated on your girlfriend one time in the past. Now, for the rest of your life, or at least to that girl, you are a cheater for all of eternity, right? What's the saying? Once a cheater, always a cheater. So that can kind of create this chaotic repetition whereby you're always that person in your own mind and you're always beating yourself up for those facts. And occasionally, of course, you know, things like therapy can help out with these type of situations, right? Especially, you know, long drawn out either psychoanalysis or cognitive behavioral therapy can kind of help you deal with those particular types of issues. But occasionally, it doesn't hurt to, you know, take something in order to be able to induce a different mental state so you can see what those stories are that are running your lives at any particular moment. So I know this all sounds kind of woo-woo, but let me kind of discuss what I'm talking about here. So when I took MDMA for the first time, I basically, everything that was kind of pent up inside me, these deep feelings of trauma, dealing with, you know, seeing things I did while working for Child Protective Services, along with a lot of things that happened to me when I was younger, you know, they kind of just swelled up and hit me all at once. And this deep feeling of empathy just soared through me, like just skyrocketed straight into my brain, where I felt not only love for all of the people that it happened to, but in a weird way, this love even for me, for acknowledging that I am capable of getting through that and able to kind of move forward. So it was a great way of being able to deal with that trauma. And I kind of saw what were the things that were running my life. And a lot of my life is being run on things like shame and guilt for things that I did in the past. So it was a good step forward. Here's the thing. It's a shortcut, but it's not the end point. Dealing with trauma isn't something that goes and is done with in a day, right? It takes years and years for it to build up. So the idea that it can go away in 24 hours is a tad bit ridiculous. And if you want proof of this, if you buy into this, some of these people will say that, you know, all we need to do is all take shrooms or acid or ayahuasca in order to have a peaceful world. Well, the Mayans and the Aztecs were taking plenty of drugs while chopping off each other's heads, right? The basis for many different religions are hallucinogenic drugs, right? There's a lot of writings on that that I'm not going to hit all into right here, but a huge basis for what we consider a lot of these narratives are based off of the use of psychedelic drugs. And honestly, it's great that religious stories and myths are based off of these, but many of these tribal people were also equally violent as human beings are right now, if not more so, and they were high to the gills on a consistent basis. So it's not a great end point, it's a good start point. So when I was at Anarcopoco, a lot of people were trying to sell me on this idea of doing ayahuasca, right? And this is a South American drug that is put together with different plants and herbs that essentially, you know, allow for a huge amount of dimethyltryptamine to be able to shoot from your, what is it, pineal gland or third eye. And it puts you in a really hallucinatory state for a number of hours. And people, you know, really tried to sell me on, you know, acid and ecstasy. These are nothing in comparison to this amazing drug. Now, for me personally, the use of things like shrooms, you know, these are in a way an interesting religious experience for me. I don't just take them willy-nilly and just, you know, run out to the beach. Although I know there's merit to doing that and it can be fun. But, you know, honestly, while I was working for the state, I actually took I think it was 6 grams of psychedelic mushrooms and kind of, this wasn't in the book, but it played a part in recognizing that what I was doing was wrong. You know, it helped me really come to terms with who the person I was and if I wanted to be that person anymore. Turns out, no, I didn't. So I can understand the religious experience of these drugs, though. But these people who were selling it to me, some of them I knew, well, they were certainly not healed individuals. I know they were living off this, like, high. And there was, by the way, this is not to, I know there's a lot of different people bringing up ayahuasca. This is not a particular person. And if you think I'm aiming at you, I'm probably not. But I knew that this particular person certainly was not healed in any way. In fact, they were living a life that involved things like scams and had other stuff going on in their lives, which wasn't great. And he was trying to tell me that, you know, now I feel no shame, no guilt, and I don't hate other people, and I'm just filled with love and radiance. And, you know, okay, all right. Then I started really thinking about this. What could be the result A lot of these, by the way, people were attractive. I mean, attractive women, right? What would be the result of a bunch of attractive women going into the middle of the jungle and doing a bunch of drugs with random old dudes? Doesn't take a long time to think about it, right? What do you think is going to happen? Yeah, exactly. So, you know, you're you know, trying to find yourself. You're doing yoga. You're submerging yourself. You're consistently trying to find some sense of nirvana, some kind of meaning in the universe. And this godless universe is filled with pain. So you go into these, you know, long meditative routes where you think about how I simply need to think myself into happiness, and it's not working for you. You go to self-help, you know, seminars, things like that. That doesn't work, right? You start doing psychedelics, and they worked at first, but you need to keep doing more and more. So you're like, you know what? Fuck it. I'm going to go hang out with this tribal people, because them and their mud huts, they definitely got their shit together, right? That's kind of the process that's happening here. Oh, well, these guys, they figured out how to mix one drug with another one, and then you get really high. Isn't that amazing? I mean, how is it possible that anyone ever even thought of that? While you're Googling that on a phone that shoots out information to fucking space. I mean, I get it. It's cool. You mix two different plants together, yada, yada. You get kind of high. Ooh, this is mystical. And that's wonderful. But to compare that as some like divine revelation while you're, you know, zooming around in these steel vessels that are jettisoning you through, you know, space and time, known as an airplane, gotta say, that's a little bit more miraculous. So you're some girl, you're hot, you're trying to find yourself, you decide to go to the jungle, and this guy says, oh, hey, or excuse me, and speaks in whatever foreign language he does, I'm going to go ahead and give you this thing. You know, we're going to go through some long ritualistic process, and now we're going to stick you with a particular type of drug that can actually stick you in a very sexual healing kind of feeling, right? And you're going to be high out of your mind and incredibly susceptible to other individuals during this process. By the way, it's going to take a couple of days, and I'm going to seem like a god to you, right? I'm bestowing you, to you, the ability to see the fucking universe. If you think dudes don't end up manipulating that on occasion just because they're shamans, then you're wrong. And it turns out there's been actually a lot of sexual assault that's going on with these ayahuasca ceremonies. Now the question obviously becomes, okay, is the per capita chance or the percentage chance of you getting sexually traumatized in these treatment facilities higher than somewhere else? I don't know. You know what I mean? That statistic is actually quite difficult to find because there's a lot of victim blaming when it comes to the spiritual community. People say, oh, well, you manifested sexual trauma or rape. And there really is that kind of victim blaming that goes on in these types of areas, because a lot of the naturalistic point of views, or these homeopathic remedy kind of point of views, you know, hippy-dippy stuff, there's victim blaming going on everywhere. The reason why people have cancers, it's their fault. The reason why, you know, bad things are going on in the world is because you don't have the right mental space. And though I enjoy the sense of autonomy that you can get from that on occasion, this whole consistent victim blaming and blaming yourself for everything can lead to some detrimental consequences. For instance, not calling out people who are sexually harassing other individuals and blaming on themselves for, oh, maybe I showed myself a certain way to this man, or maybe I put myself in this position. And maybe you did. It doesn't justify it, right? If I walk into a place where another individual has a gun, I could have seen that he had a gun, but I wasn't looking exactly enough, and then he shoots at me. It's not my fault, right? I could have been a little bit smarter about my decisions of what I did. And so the sense of autonomy should really come from, okay, what are some things I can do in the future to not stick myself in these very risky situations whereby I can be manipulated and taken advantage of? So in my mind, it's, hey, why don't we figure out a way to be able to do ayahuasca in areas in which, you know, maybe there's a toilet or, you know, maybe there's not this humongously fucked up power dynamic that occurs in these particular situations where, you know, someone can take advantage of other individuals. And so that's something that can occur that is incredibly detrimental. Now, someone did bring up to me, well, you know, a lot of these kind of things happen at a bar also. But at a bar, you know, you have friends. You have other people you can say, hey, time out. I need a taxi. You can't really take a taxi while you're high to the fucking gills on ayahuasca in the middle of Central America, right? Where no one talks your language and you are the absolute most vulnerable. And the worst thing is how absolutely traumatic this could possibly be, because you are your most vulnerable state, right? You have all the filters down. You have everything broken down. You're coming to terms with your dad who beat and molested you. You're having to deal with all these different situations. Then the shaman comes along and starts, you know, touching your vagina and attempting to rape you. I mean, how mind-breaking can that become? You have an individual who's dealing with real fucking trauma, who's never been able to come to terms with these things. And then you take advantage of it. I mean, Jesus fucking Christ, how terrible of a person must you be? So, I would say when it comes to dealing with these particular type of situations, like traumatic, post-traumatic stress disorder, these issues, mixing these psychedelics with actual therapy in comforting situations with say, therapists, right, or, you know, long-term friends who understand things like therapy, things like that, can be really beneficial. Because what I found was, yeah, I did MDMA. And then, yeah, I wrote this article about post-traumatic stress disorder, but it wasn't all done with, man. I wasn't all done. I still had a lot of hangups. I still had a lot of things that were going on in my life that I wasn't dealing with. And they ended up kind of hurting me in the future. And one more piece of little advice here for you, Nick. If you're going to try ecstasy or any psychedelic for the first time and a lot of it at once, it's probably not the best idea to start dating the person who you did that drug with, because when you have enough chemicals floating into your brain so quickly, you might end up in a particular type of situation whereby you start thinking, oh, I love this person, and really it was just you loved the drug, and that can end up kind of hurting you. I've seen it with a few people, and since doing it a few different times, I've kind of caught myself. I remember I was at a music festival one time, and I was out there. It was Alex Gray. Yeah, Terrence is dead. My bad. Alex Gray was painting on the stage, and there's this huge music festival out in LA, right? It's a big auditorium. And I had taken, like, I don't know, some LSD. And I started talking to this girl, and I'm having this wonderful conversation. It's amazing and everything else. And I'm realizing, you're not really enamored with this girl. You're really enamored with this drug. And she's a vessel, and you're a vessel for her to push out all of this information that you have about the universe and about how you feel. But that's not a legitimate basis for a relationship. It's just a fun time. And because both me and her had this, by the way, is total stranger, right? But because, you know, we had both done these, you know, these psychedelics before, at the end of it, we're like, you know what? It was awesome to know you. And we both just kind of like walked away. We're like, you know what? That was a pleasurable experience. We got the entire relationship in about five, you know, a couple hours there when the entire trip went by. That could be, you know, a totally positive thing. Just try to keep your head kind of connected to reality. Occasionally, you can open your mind so wide that your brain falls completely out. All right. And you do not want to be in that particular type of situation, because I've seen some guys not deal well with it. And of course, psychedelics, just like so many other things, can start to be abused. Right. So you start to get, it's not physically addictive. I'm not, you know, oh, man, I need the LSD. Right. But there's a part of you that is driven to be able to feel that way again. And the problem is that every single time you try to chase that dragon another time, well, you know, chasing the dragon, you can't grab hold of it again. Right. So the first time you're wanting to get back there so hard, right? And you're forgetting that what you're supposed to do is, when you take those magical journeys into the, you know, into the depths of reality, out into the universe, you got to grab a hold, right? And then bring some of it back with you. Don't just keep going and bouncing back and assuming you'll get that same feeling again. Don't disrespect the drug or disrespect the brain. You know, this is why I'm not telling people you should go take ecstasy every week. You know, you can do whatever the hell you want. I don't really care. You can go get, you know, drunk off your ass right now. It just might not be the best suggestion, especially if we're talking about your ability to comprehend or deal with reality in the future. I certainly know that after the first time I did MDMA, which was a lot, by the way, I was grinding the shit out of my teeth for a good 48 hours. Thankfully, I had a lot of gum and water, but man, it is a thing. Anyway, 17 minutes later, as you can tell, I put a lot of thought into this whole dealing with drug issue. Okay, so going from the topic of doing drugs, right, we're going to go to the topic of, in this particular case, justice. Give me one moment here. actually, yeah. So let me run up to this. So someone had posted on a page that I follow on Facebook, and then someone actually asked me a question regarding the exact same case, which was that there was a Poland confirms Minnesota man as a Nazi commander. So the question that was asked was, okay, we have this 98-year-old guy, 98-year-old dude, right, who used to be a Nazi commander, right? He's living in Minneapolis, Minnesota right now. So here we go. Poland will seek the arrest and extradition of a Minnesota man exposed by the Associated Press as a former commander in an SS-led unit that burned Polish villages and killed civilians in World War II, prosecutors said Monday. Prosecutor Robert Janikai said evidence gathered over years of investigation into U.S. citizen Michael K. confirmed 100% that he was a commander of a unit in the SS-led Ukrainian Self-Defense Legion. He did not release the last name in line with Poland's privacy laws, but the AP has identified the man as 98-year-old Michael Kerkok. Kerkok? Whatever. From Minneapolis. Quote, all the pieces of evidence interwoven together allow us to say the person who lives in the U.S. is Michael K., who commanded the Ukrainian Self-Defense Legion, which carried out the pacification of Polish villages in the Lublin region. It's interesting that when you're trying to convict someone, you're still using the word pacification rather than genocide. Anyway, the decision in Poland came 4 years after the AP published a story establishing that Michael Kerkok commanded the unit based on wartime documents, testimony from other members of the unit, and Karkok's own Ukrainian language memoir. Now, his son and other members of his family have decided to, you know, fight off, say that none of this stuff is proven to be true. But the Polish government is pretty pushing on it, and they are trying to get him charged for life in prison from murders that he did back in 1944. So, this is a question of justice, you know, decades and decades and decades later. How does this pertain to, you know, something like the non-aggression principle? What would libertarian justice be? Or, in my case, what I actually give a fuck about, what would justice be in general? So, one of the issues is, how long do we wait until we start to put every single war criminal in prison? Right? Because it's not just this guy. I don't even like the term war criminal. Crimes of war, right? I mean, every single war is a crime against humanity. So, and innocents are lost every single time. Should all the people who've droned people in Iraq and Afghanistan, should they all be thrown in prison because innocents died in those particular occasions? Is it a matter of intent? Does a six-year-old care whether or not it died due to someone's intention being good or bad? Now, in this particular case, the question of intention for me is a little bit of an odd one. And I think it pertains here. Intent absolutely pertains because you have to think about, you know, individuals in these places, in these times in history. The vast majority of human beings right now who are living in a lot of the places that you're living in right now, who you're listening to from this podcast, if you were around in pre-World War II world, you know, Germany, and your life has been destroyed, your economy is completely in the shitter, you have been ritualistically abused since you were a kid. Child abuse was massive in Bavaria and lots of other places around the world, of course, right? But it was interesting that the things that they called the Jews, like rotten scoundrels, everything else, these specific German terms were also used to call Jewish people. So it was like they turned their the vessel of all their hate on from their kids onto Jewish people. Anyway, and, you know, anyone who wasn't, you know, your standard Aryan. But if you stick people in these situations, they are more than likely going to end up being as bad as the other guys in these cases, right? Like we all want to be the hero in our life story. And that's what I'm trying for right now. But we have to understand that the majority of individuals in these kind of circumstances are not going to rise above that. They're going to fall and be part of the social milieu in that particular case. You know? So if we're going to convict this 98-year-old guy who apparently also has Alzheimer's, we're going to have to convict all of the Russian soldiers who were involved in the gulags. We're going to have to, you know, arrest shit tons of Japanese soldiers. I mean, they just raped and killed countless Chinese individuals just, you know, 60 years ago. We're going to have to go to, you know, Korea and throw a bunch of other soldiers in jail, including Koreans who ended up coming to the United States and marrying and raising families just as much as this guy did. Right, we're going to have to throw tons of Vietnam vets into prisons, right? Because the American government committed complete genocide out in Vietnam with absolutely no positive results. Although war, of course, rarely good results, but really, really bad in Vietnam. And we're talking about loads of individuals who are going to be thrown in prison. And this is where the topic of redemption comes into mind. Now, me particularly, you know, we were talking about the topic of MDMA just a second ago. So I had gone from being the CPS investigator guy who did some pretty fucked up shit working for the state, you know. So I'm sure as hell some people wanted me thrown in prison. Or not thrown in prison, but necessarily, although I've heard people say they want to kill me. You know, things you hear as an adult because you do shit. Interesting. Anyway, so the in the case of something like Child Protective Services as an investigator, you know, I came to terms of what I was doing was wrong, and then I had to change my life, and I did. Should I now be thrown in prison for what I did? Should if there is some great anarchistic experience that the revolution and everything gets great and we're in the utopia of Ancapistan, do I now get thrown in a prison cell? Because I used to work for the government. Just ask yourself that question. Maybe it is. Maybe it's yes. I could be wrong. Like, maybe I deserve to be. I don't think so. I think a lot of what I've done since then has been to promote peace, but I could be wrong. I mean, my numbers could be off. But this is the kind of purview that I'm taking in this particular case, right? What do we gain from, you know, killing some 90-year-old Alzheimer's guy? What does it say about human beings? Do we want to promote the idea of justice or mercy? I like mercy. I like mercy because it frees yourself from the pain, frees the other individual as well. But it really is a difficult thing to say. I would say the majority, though, of the people that this older gentleman dealt with, most of the fallout there, a lot of those people, individuals, are already dead, right? Any like really close relatives in those particular cases. But, you know, I just do not see the benefit of going after every single war criminal ever and throwing them all in prisons, because our prisons are going to run out of spaces pretty damn quickly. The vast majority of human history has been filled with blood and war. Do we want to continue that blood and war by capturing every single human being who's ever been involved with war and expect, one, to not get another war, and two, to ever have any form of justice? I mean, how does this work? And what pisses me off is the anarchists and libertarians who are like, oh, fuck that dude, punch that Nazi in the face. You know, I'll fuck up that old dude. You know, get the fuck off your keyboard. You've never punched anyone in your life. You're just sitting around waiting to die or you're yelling at people online. Good job. You did a lot in life. You really made it. You spoke out against a Nazi, because that's hard, right? That's really controversial. Kill a 90-year-old guy because I'm anti-Nazi and that makes me great. That kind of virtue signaling, I hate using that word, but man, it feels like virtue signaling in that particular case, right? That's really tiresome. It's not ended up in any kind of positive situation overall throughout the whole of human history. It's kind of redemptive justice thing. And restitution seems to make a lot more sense. Okay, so outside of that, zing, 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 let's get to another question here. Wow, this is easier than I thought it was going to be. We get to do this all in one go. Alrighty, so I have a few more things here. So I want to hit on, okay, I'm just going to have a third question here because we're already a good 20 seconds in. And it's on the topic of faith. So, what is your definition of faith? Do you believe most religious people follow the definition, or do they use another definition? Perfect. Okay, cool. Alrighty. Faith. All right. So, I've done a lot of podcasts on this particular topic. I did one. My big one was like, faith is the root of all evil. Something like that. It was just, I did a little series on the topic of faith. So faith is believing in something in spite of or in direct contradiction to reason or evidence. Cool, right? That's a simple enough definition. I have faith that gravity doesn't exist, right? It's an opposition to reality. The thing is, though, is it's not that simple, because there's a second definition, which is which instead of meaning that, it means something exactly the opposite. That's the son of a bitch about words, right? Because communication is a form of bastardized telepathy where we're trying to just create an image in another person's mind. So when we decide to take one word and make it mean multiple things, it's really fucking up that form of telepathy, right? Because the images in the other human being's minds, it's hard to comprehend. It's hard to understand. It's hard to think about, right? So the topic of faith, right? When most people say it, a lot of times it's, I have faith that Nick is going to come back to work tomorrow. Well, if Nick's the kind of guy who goes to work every day, well, you have reason to believe based off of prior evidence that Nick is going to come. That's a good calculation. That just makes sense. Reason to believe based off of evidence. Cool. Right. Now, if Nick is coming into class, if you say Nick's going to come in the office tomorrow, but Nick is dead, or Nick's a drunk and he rarely ever comes to class or school or the office or wherever, rarely ever shows up to anywhere, right? The chance of him coming in, quite low. Right. In fact, almost impossible. So that would be the faith is using in spite of or in contradiction to reason or evidence. So I would say the one that means in spite of evidence or reason is probably a negative. Except it can be a little bit more obscure than that. Because a lot of our life is run off of assumptions. Now, we can say it's based off the best available evidence, but in some cases it's not, right? I believe that being an honest and virtuous human being at this stage of my life makes me feel like a happier person and that I may be more successful in the future because of that. I do not know if that's true. I know for me personally, in my own mind, based off of my life, attempting to be honest with other individuals can prove to be a beneficial thing, right? But does that mean that it's always going to be the best situation in every single relationship or in every single friendship or in every single business transaction? Possibly not. But I have faith that faith, I guess, in the idea that it's a good thing to do. So it's hard to tamper with here. If what you believe, though, is in contradiction to reality in and of itself, that's where you can get really fucked up, right? If you come down with cancer, right? Come down with cancer like it's a cold. Okay. Well, hell, no. We can go. Yeah. So if you actually no, this is a good analogy here. If you come down with a cold, and you say I have faith this homeopathic remedy is going to heal me and you get better, not that you know whatever, not a big deal. Now homeopathy, if anyone doesn't know, is water or just pure alcohol, because what it has to do is they say that the more times you dilute the particular drug or the particular substance, the more powerful it is, right? It's like saying the more I dilute this punch by adding more and more air in between it, the stronger it will be. Suddenly I'm 10,000 feet away throwing a punch and I assume it's going to be super strong Mike Tyson punch level. It's not, right? It's not how physics works. And by the way, people should look that up. If you don't understand how homeopathy and like organic and natural are different, you should really Google that shit, because that homeopathic remedy stuff that they have at Whole Foods, it's crap. there's no energy in it. It's water you're spending. You know, there's homeopathy without borders. I mean, anyway, okay. And actually, no, this is a corollary. But so we have the cold one, right? So in this case, having faith in homeopathy didn't end up being too detrimental because you would have gotten better anyway because it's a cold. Let's say you have cancer, right? And then you use that same lapse in logic and reason and say, I'm going to take homeopathic remedies, like let's say horse pee homeopathy or whatever. by the way, that's a Dr. Brzezinski reference. If you've watched that terrible documentary, let's say I'm going to take this homeopathic remedy and it's going to cure my cancer, and then you die real quick, right? And before that, you started a blog and told everyone that homeopathy worked for you. Right now, all these people have faith in it, and they never double-check to see whether or not you're dead. Well, now that faith is actually really detrimental to humankind, right? Because now a lot of people are going to have faith in something that is in stark contradiction to reason and reality, and I believe Ayn Rand kind of put it, there's only so long that you can last ignoring the evidence, right? Ignoring reality. After a while, I can say gravity doesn't exist, but if I jump off a cliff, I'm going to die. or at least break a lot of stuff in between. And so it is important that though I do argue that individuals are intuitive more than purely rational creatures, right? We believe something or we have an emotional reaction to something and then we rationalize afterwards, right? We usually don't just come up with things rationally in the first place. That does not omit the importance of reason and rationality and the understanding of grammar, logic, and rhetoric, right? So if I'm emotionally attached to something, that even means even more so that I should attempt to get the most amount of evidence I possibly can. Now, on the topic of you know, faith and religion as a whole, I would say that these religious individuals are not purely irrational creatures. I probably said that when I was like 18 or something, but I was wrong. Many of them come to not necessarily believe in God as this like real creature in the sky, but as these stories that tell us a deeper truth about ourselves and reality as a whole. You find this a lot in Eastern mysticism, but you find it in Abrahamic tradition as well. A lot of Jews, for instance, don't actually believe in God. They believe in the stories that are being told, right? Now, a lot of blood, sweat, and tears went through, you know, this kind of revelation. Go ahead and look up one out of the four Crusades, right? So we can say Christianity's chill now, for the most part, in a lot of places, right? You can find good merits in the narrative of Jesus Christ and things like that. But if you take a look at the Fourth Crusades, you know, between the, which a lot had more to do with power structures than Eastern Orthodox Christians and Western, although Eastern Orthodox religion, I'll do a Crusades episode later. Just to say, but the finer nuances of Christianity were dealt with blood. Throughout majority of human history. So faith can obviously lead to some rather violent ends. And so blind faith in authority-based figures is generally a negative thing that we want to be steering ourselves away from and trying to use reason and truth as a way to determine what is in fact what is going on within reality as a whole. And through that, we can end up in a better situation in our world. And through that attempt at nuance and rationality and reason mixed with empathy, it all kind of ties together. You know, that's how MDMA, empathy, Nazi, then faith and cancer. It all kind of coalesces in a really strange way. And I think there's a nice beauty to that and understanding that all of these different parts of us, all of these wants and our needs and our cravings in this life, it all kind of comes together. And we kind of take all this information in and process it using our senses and then come out attempting to live in a better world as a whole. And in all of these abilities, in all these different topics, it's so easy to rush to judgment immediately. But the time between when evidence comes in and when you decide to process a response, stimulus response, there's a time there, and that time is for thinking and thought. And the more we can open that up and put our critical lens out to try to better understand things, the better off we are. Which is why being in a perpetual state of MDMA is probably a bad idea, but it's a nice little opening just for a second so that you can then take that back with you later on. And so you can be a stronger, more critical thinker. I think all that tied together, and I realize this might have sounded a little bit rushed, but this is actually, check this out, guys. This is the first time I've ever done a show by myself where there will be no editing. So if you like it, please send me a message if you have more questions or anything else. This was a lot of fun. This was it took me 37 minutes to produce a show rather than 8 hours. So I really enjoyed it. I hope to hear some responses from y'all. Of course, make sure to check thinkaboutnow.com/podcast. If you like the show, go ahead and donate. You can find that on a little RSS feed. Occasionally, people like to throw me a few shekels. It's been a good 3 years of podcasting. I believe I've made about a cent an hour, and I'm totally fine with that. I mean, I'm overwhelmed whenever I get to meet fans of the show. When I was out in Acapulco, I got to meet some really cool people. Oh, and so if you have any questions for me later on, go ahead and send them to me on Facebook. I'm Carlos Morales on there. You can also post it on the Think About Now Facebook page. Also, if you're really inclined to do so, you can email me at thecpswhistleblower@gmail.com. Actually, let me go ahead and double check that real quick. I believe it's the CPS whistleblower. Yeah, I wonder if Edward Snowden has the the NSA whistleblower at gmail.com. That would be a hoot. Thankfully, the CPS doesn't have the kind of money that the NSA does. Thank Jesus. So message me on either one of those, and I will keep in contact with y'all soon. Go ahead again. I'm going to be speaking in Phoenix on March 18th from 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. at the Hotel San Carlos. And you can find it on Facebook by just Googling in there or Facebook searching Family Rights Summit.
Fucked with